is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you joining us today for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with that esteemed cohort that listens to us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room where you can roll in with some of the usual suspects. I see Kim and Paul there guarding the front door. So if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or you have a question you would like for us to direct to our guest while we go forward, that's a great place to hang out and share that information with us. And if you have to leave and take care of some business, and you missed part of the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, the best thing to do, if you haven't already, go over to iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast aggregator you use and subscribe to the podcast. And that way it'll be ready there and waiting for you when your busy schedule allows. And we're going to go ahead and roll into today's show. And as we put in the pre-show announcement, keeping a fleet ready for war is a process of years of careful, consistent, and sustained stewardship of not just existing equipment, purchasing new equipment, and of course the sailors and Marines that make it all happen. And the easiest parts are the buying of equipment, the recruiting of new personnel. That's what gets most of the attention. But there are a lot more arguably important items going on in the background that rarely get the attention, whether that's things like dry docks or the actual process that everything is designed around. And today, that's what things we're going to touch on. For our fleet today, the schedule that determines what's ready, where, and when is called the Optimized Fleet Response Plan, OFRP, as we'll refer to it from here on out. And it's a system few understand well, but it's one designed around efficiency as we become accustomed to in our warm peacetime experience, with only a passing interest, almost as a byproduct of combat effectiveness. And in that background, you have to wonder whether your decades of dominance at sea has provided our Navy an opportunity to focus on that. But we're reaching a period where that dominance is already, at least regionally, challenged or about to be significantly challenged as China expands her fleet. Do we need a new construct? And is the system we're presently using really fit for purpose? We've got a returning guest today to talk about this and the other related topics to keep us all up to speed. And that is Brian McGrath, Commander, U.S. Navy, retired, and Managing Director of the Ferry Bridge Group. Brian, welcome back to Midrats.
Pleasure to be with you guys.
I thought as a kickoff for our listeners that may not know any more about the OFRP than what I just outlined there for a second. If you could, for the listener, to give them kind of the foundation to be able to hang the other things we're going to talk on here for most of the hour, outline in broad terms, what are some of the fundamental cornerstones of the OFRP, how it relates to our fleet?
So OFRP is a force readiness and force provision scheme that was created at Fleet Forces Command several years ago. I would say probably 2011 would be my guess when it was first a gleam in then Rear Admiral Phil Davidson's eye when he was the ops boss at Fleet Forces Command. And it was an attempt to reconcile a few things. One was that there was a constant demand for naval forces. Two was that there is a relatively inflexible number of ships to meet that demand. Three, when you have a rotational force, that force must deploy, it must rest, it must train, it must do maintenance. Those things all have to be accounted for in the life cycle of that ship. Essentially, what the Optimized Fleet Response Plan does is it took the assets, the deploying assets of the United States Navy, which did not include the 7th Fleet ships, but the ones in Norfolk and Hawaii and San Diego and Mayport and Bremerton and so on. Those ships essentially went into a schedule where there was a predictability to it, and one of the goals of OFRP was to provide predictability, and that predictability was to be provided to the sailor and the sailor's family. That predictability was to be provided to the repair and upkeep industrial base, so that they would be able to plan and develop workforce their workforce to meet the needs. And the predictability was to be provided to the customer, the numbered fleet commanders and the Navy component commanders. The big difference in the way we did things before was that we had, and this is a little bit of a simplistic way to look at it, was that we had a demand-based model, which was there was a certain demand from the end users for Navy assets, and we created our readiness system around that demand. Admiral Greenert and Admiral Davidson and Admiral Gortney down at Second Fleet, at Fleet Forces, who was the four-star down there, they decided to turn that on its ear and turn our system into a supply-driven model. And that supply-driven model was going to privilege things like depot-level maintenance, a basic training phase, sufficient time for basic training phase to earn certifications and the like, an intermediate phase, an advanced training phase, a deployment phase, and a sustainment phase before you start all over again in a maintenance phase, training phase, and so on. This is the way we've been doing it for a few years now, where this supply-driven model is providing ready strike groups at a predictable interval to be employed by the geographic combatant commanders and their agents, the naval component commanders, in accordance with the global force management process. That's where we are. We changed our mentality from demand driven to supply driven. Admiral Greenert made a lot of noise about this, about, you know, we're gonna change this, and we're gonna have to say no. We're gonna say no, and that was sort of the mantra for a few years. The problem was that OFRP made an awful lot of sense in 1992 and 1993, when the wall fell, when we were a dominant naval power, when there was no one challenging us in the blue water. It would have made great sense through the 90s and through the aughts, but we didn't do it. We didn't do it till 2011 or so, by which time great power competition had already begun to peek its head up above the foxhole. And so my theory is, and it caused me to write an extended tweet storm on this, which Sal picked up on. My theory is that we're out of phase, and that the OFRP is wonderful for producing a predictable amount of naval readiness at predictable intervals. But we just put a defense strategy out a few years ago that talked about increasing operational flexibility and unpredictability. And we have not one but two great powers that are contesting with us. And so I think we're out of phase again. We're out of phase. That OFRP is, generally speaking, unsuited for what we see right before us in the great power dynamic environment. And I was happy to see BCNO Burke quoted in the press relatively recently that he seemed to agree that OFRP might have to be revised based on the way things have changed.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the 2018 National Defense Strategy, I guess that's what it is, which calls for this dynamic force employment concept. What does that mean, and why? What is the distinction between what we're doing now and what, I mean, you've kind of gone over this, but it's worth repeating and kind of talking about it in depth. The distinction between that and what we currently do when we now have X number of prepared ships to go at Y time to hang around for 6 or 8 months someplace.
Yeah, for one thing, the OFRP model of employing naval power and distributing it to the combatant commanders is the antithesis of dynamism. It is predictability, and that model of predictable force deployed at predictable intervals to largely predictable operating areas was what we were doing. In the 2018, let's start with the 2017 National Security Strategy. The National Security Strategy had a nugget in it that laid upon the armed forces the order that we would move from a paradigm of conventional deterrence by punishment to one of conventional deterrence by denial. The difference is that if you deploy, if someone decides not to do something for fear that the carrier strike group over the horizon is going to come and ruin their day, that is the threat of punishment. We determined in our planning processes that because Russia and China had modest potential targets for aggression very close to their near abroad, that the threat of, you know, retaliation from a strike group might not be something they take all that seriously, because they could present us with a fait accompli if they decided to unleash their aggression. They could essentially take what they wanted, sit there and say, come at me. Then the question is, do we want to come at a nuclear power who is dug in? And that is one of the reasons why this whole concept of deterrence by denial, or excuse me, by punishment, was scrapped for deterrence by denial, which deterrence by denial means you need to have forces in place, powerful lethal forces in place, that their very presence, their power, their lethality, their network, their capability, all their interoperability with allies, that all of those factors go into an opponent not deferring his aggression because he's afraid of the punishment that would come from over the horizon, but that they defer it because of a fear that they just aren't going to succeed because of what's facing them in the theater. Connected to this big idea of deterrence by denial, what were the, you know, the National Defense Strategy's concepts of a blocking force and a blunt force, so that there would be some level of powerful forces in place that would be there to perform this deterrence by denial, but then there would also be some force over the horizon. And the second thing that this national defense strategy talked about was dynamic fleet employment. When you levy on naval operating forces the requirement to be dynamic, in a paradigm where they are being prepared for overseas deployments, in a paradigm that values predictability, you have some disconnect. This was one of my major criticisms of the NDS when it came out, was that I believe – it wasn't a criticism. I like dynamic fleet employment, by the way. But that there would be a disconnect between OFRP and DFE, dynamic fleet employment. When I had a nice long meeting with then-VCNO Moran in his office about this subject, I don't know, a year and a half ago, and what Admiral Moran said to me was that we were going to be dynamic within the OFRP. One of the things we saw was the Theodore Roosevelt deployment. I think it was Theodore Roosevelt, right, that deployed out of Norfolk, went into the Mediterranean for a little bit, operated over there. All of the people who would have been watching that deployment would have predicted they would have gone through the Suez and headed on over to CENTCOM. But instead, they headed back to Norfolk and went back into port and maintained readiness in Norfolk. And there was a great deal of, you know, question asking in the press and in intelligence circles and the like. So there was I think that was an example of dynamic fleet employment. The carrier deployed on time, but it then turned around and came back halfway through its deployment. And that sent a signal that, hey, this isn't business as usual. And then I think it was 6 weeks later, they packed up and got underway again and went back up to the Arctic Circle and operated. They never went to CENTCOM. They stayed in the 6th Fleet AOR and the 2nd Fleet AOR. So what they did is they operated dynamically within the deployment portion of the OFRP. That is what I think the Navy hopes to do, is to be more dynamic and unpredictable with operating forces within the time available that for them to deploy. There is a second time available for ships to deploy within the OFRP, and it's called the sustainment phase. When a ship returns from deployment, it is required to maintain its battle readiness and its certifications for some set period of time so that it can act as a surge force and it can redeploy. This was another place where Admiral Moran pointed to me that naval forces would add some dynamism, and I questioned him on that, because I said to him that that is a nice idea. The problem is we don't resource to that kind of dynamism from the sustainment phase. And he granted that I had a point, and that there would be some arguing necessary to attain those resources. So that's I think how the Navy intends to wrap dynamic fleet employment around OFRP.
I think that sounds like a compromise. So a compromise in the right direction, because I've always shared your concerns about the perfect efficiency you can find in the OFRP, that it gives you X number of deployments for Y number of ships, as long as everything stays in a nice predictable order, and then you could have your optimized number of support structures. However, as any deer hunter will tell you, if you're an aggressor, which is what a hunter is, the one thing you absolutely hope for, which is why trail cameras are a $1 billion business, is predictability. If you know that you want a certain target, you do all you can to find out what their rhythms are, what their habits are, and then you set up to take advantage of that. And as a result, you know, the bucks that survive the longest time are the most unpredictable. So is part of your critique of the OFRP and the conversation and the focus on peer competition, at least regionally, pushing towards trying to get some degree of unpredictability, because part of that predictability has to do with the fact that if they do say, come and get me, we can only do it for a short period of time. While unpredictability and different levels of sustain, it gives the ability to do kind of what happened when you and I were little kids, which was the tremendous surge of forces that we saw during Desert Storm.
You bring up a very good point, and it's a point I want to get to in a second, but I need to do something first to cover my own ass, and that is to make sure that everyone listening understands that I am a consultant to the Navy, but what you hear me say today is either factual or my opinion, and that nothing else, nothing that I say today will be Navy opinion that isn't based up by fact, okay? I hope everybody gets that. Unpredictability is something obviously we wish to have. You mentioned the word compromise, and I think what the National Defense Strategy recognizes is that we don't have all the things that we need. We don't have all the ships. We don't have all the aircraft carriers. We don't have all the submarines. And again, I'm going to speak specifically to Navy stuff because that's the people that listen to the show, and it's the stuff I know about. And that we needed to be – and because we didn't have enough stuff, we needed to use that stuff more unpredictably. I believe that's a smart way to play a bad hand. Now, in Washington, D.C. and in the naval advocacy game, you can be like some people who I respect greatly – who have a tremendous ability to help explain to you how to spend the same amount of money more effectively or to get more combat utility out of the same amount of money. I'm not interested in that discussion. I'm not interested in compromises between unpredictability and force structure. My goal and the rock I push up a hill is that if we were to have the Navy that we need, the Navy that this nation deserves and should demand, it would have sufficient lethal force deployed 365 days a year, seven days a week, to the areas that we believe are most important to us. To me, that's North Atlantic, Mediterranean, Indian Ocean, CENTCOM area, and the Western Pacific. We would resource to that. Dynamic fleet employment, OFRP. What we're doing is trying to be predictable with an efficient way of producing force. I would like to have a less efficient force production model, which means more overlap, more ships, more capability, more surge capacity, and still be unpredictable with that force. That would take considerably more money than most people are willing to spend, but that's why I go around speaking and talking about why we need more.
Yeah, I always look at this stuff as that most of the time the fleet's in a three-phase situation. You got ships that are in maintenance, you got ships that are gearing up for deployment, you got deployed ships, and you just repeat the cycle. And given that, maybe it's in a four group, you know, there's no reason that I can see without a slightly larger fleet, you couldn't go to a four or five section where you had a deployable force follow and along with that at home an eminently deployable force. In other words, you have two groups ready to go. One is actually deployed. The other one is a force in readiness to go if you need to surge that. Is that possible under the dynamic force employment or under the process we have in the Navy now?
Yeah, I think so. I think that Admiral Moran had a point. I think that you know, you've got a reasonable number of assets in sustainment phase at any one time, I think it would be a little bit Pollyanna of me to say that those forces are, and I don't have the data to back this up, but my guess is that we probably are not as ready in that sustainment force as we would like to be. And that that sustainment force is really what we need. We need to keep that group of ships at a really high level, manning, maintenance, certifications, warfighting edge, all of that. And I think that's going to take more money. I think what we have right now is a readiness model that does a really good job of getting ships ready to deploy and keeping them ready while they're deployed. But then that there is something of a readiness step down when they return home. That's not just a psychological thing. It's not just, whoo, we're home, deployment's over. It is also resources. It's manning. It's where, you know, are you able to keep all of your people? Where do you fit on the cannibalization chain for parts that you have for deployed or deploying assets? And that's the type commander's job to manage, and I imagine they do a good job doing that. Although I think it's probably something that we have to look harder at, and have to look harder at throwing more resources at in order to beef up that sustainment phase if we're going to actually deploy it dynamically as is desired.
Everybody's favorite readiness bathtub. And it's one of those things that's known well, but not really understood, that it's exactly what you say. It's an opportunity when that unit comes back. You can almost see the supply vultures circling the pier ready to strip things off. And it's not just ships, it's aircraft, submarines as well. I don't know the submarine visibility that much, but I'm just making assumptions there, at least from a personnel point of view. That's true. And I wonder if part of that is we have, and I wanted to pick on SecNav Mavis's tenure, but that's not fair because it predates and postdates him as well. But just as an example, the big push was always how many ships, how many aircraft we're buying, as opposed to the depot level maintenance, the dry dock availability, the sustainment stuff, the hard and the boring stuff in the background, that if you really wanted to be able to create some additional unpredictability by having more ships that are perhaps not as deep as a bathtub, I would assume we would need to have the money, of course, would have to come. But there would also have to be a period of time to reset and have perhaps a percentage decrease of that forward presence while we were able to reset and restructure to build that. Is that one of the costs, I guess, we'd have to do a reset, or do you think a reset wouldn't be necessary?
You know, there's one of these old chestnuts out there, especially on the third deck of the Pentagon, the OSD people, they have this idea that forward presence is an end unto itself, that we deploy in order to deploy, or that we are present in order to be present. That's just ridiculous. We have always tried to put forward units and formations that provide credible deterrence, incredible warfighting capability. There are serious questions as to whether that lethality and that warfighting ability was sufficient. And so you had these folks, mostly at OSD, who would say, let's just, you know, cut back on the forward presence stuff, and we'll have more in response, because that forward presence stuff is just it's a chimera. It really doesn't do what you all say it does. And I think that's just crap. And especially if you're going to if you're going to deter by denial, you have to have a force out there that is powerful, that is lethal, that is networked, that is ready. The problem is that we aren't big enough to have, at this point, we're not big enough to have sufficient force forward and sufficient force in reserve that is surgeable, that is not only surgeable, but that is ready, that is at the highest level of readiness in order to go. Break. I'd like to interrupt this podcast with a news bulletin. The Secretary of the Navy, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post are reporting that the Secretary of the Navy has resigned at the Defense Secretary's request amid controversy with the White House over the case against Navy SEALs. How about that?
Yeah, I was noticing that in the background, and it looks to me, and again, making assumptions that everything from the Washington Post report is within a half standard deviation of what happened, it looks like it had to do with a standard issue case of going around the chain of command where SecNav Spencer was trying to work a deal related to Gallagher with the White House, cutting out the Secretary of Defense, and SecDef Esper was having none of it. That's the initial flush that I got from it there. Have you heard or seen anything else, Eagle One? Or...
No, I haven't seen that. I haven't digested it. I think the interesting thing to me is how we got here. I have some time that Secretary was nearing the end of his tenure. As a historical thing, you know, secretaries of the Navy don't usually do what Ray Mabus did and stay the whole time. It's usually, I think the average is somewhere around 2 or 3 years that they stay in the job.
True.
Secretary Spencer was rather vocal in his criticisms of Congress fairly recently in the press or at a think tank event. And I remember thinking at that time and tweeting at that time that I thought that might be a man who wasn't necessarily interested in being Secretary of the Navy much longer. I can't say that all of these things, all these dots connect. I applaud Secretary for his stand, for what stand on this matter. If it took his resignation to make the what the Navy's interests and equities in this matter were, I'm glad that he decided to do it.
Interesting times, interesting events. Let's go back to what we were talking about. One of the things that concerns me. One of the things that concerns me on these things, and I think you've touched on it, it's not enough to put a force out there that's powerful and strong. You've got to sustain this force. And we don't have any tenders anymore. We have the MSC has a number of replenishment ships, but I'm not convinced we have enough replenishment ships. When we start looking at really ramping up to be as flexible as apparently dynamic force employment would have us be, in order to be, prioritized preparedness for war, we would really need to look at the whole infrastructure that supports the fighting force. Then we start talking some serious dollars and protecting that sustainment force, which then we also start talking some serious dollars. I mean, we need to do it regardless of what the strategy is. And I think with most of us who've been watching it over the years have been kind of struggling with what the heck are we going to do with somebody challenges us in the middle of the ocean. But, am I off base on this? Isn't this going to be like a huge lump of money here?
I want to push back a little bit on it. You said something. You seemed to minimize the importance of the strategy. When we were sort of sitting atop the pyramid of naval powers, and we had nobody challenging us. It was okay to get all your fuel, your bunker fuel in port. It was okay to hold off on fixing that that generator until you got back home in 6 weeks. There were decisions that people made decisions based on efficiency, not effectiveness, and that was that paradigm of efficiency over effectiveness was basically the way to describe the way the military thought about itself from, you know, the fall of the wall until very recently. With the change in the strategy and the sense that we have to that we have these tough opponents that we may have to scrap with someday, the sustainment problems that you bring up are just tremendously exacerbated and amplified. The ability to get fuel to distributed units throughout the theater, the ability to get parts and fuel and water to the Marines in their expeditionary advanced bases, the ability to do combat repairs on ships underway, the ability to reload ships and submarines forward, all of those things, which the absence of which was somewhat tolerable under a previous strategy, are now intolerable and require a great deal more investment and changes in concepts of operation to beat back and to overcome.
Ah, the I word, investment. You are a commute away from D.C. That investment means money. That's spending. That's funding line.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I do the same thing just by proxy.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the money for a minute. Let's talk about investment. That we can't do anything without money, and that supply versus demand goes back to money. And if you expect, and I do, that the Democrats are going to hold the House for the next few election cycles, they're going to, within reason, have, if not set the tone, have 51% of the vote on the financial limits that we're going to see in the Navy in the 2020s. And along those lines, you know, who do you see with a D next to their name that has a lever on power at the House that you would consider a strong advocate for not just getting the Navy's fair share of bit of the pie, but the bit of the pie that we need as a maritime and aerospace power to be able to do what the nation needs us to do?
You know, I used to be a fierce partisan. I'm not anymore because I don't have a party to support. I support an ideology. That ideology demands that we have a powerful military as part of our a very active role in the world. I think there
Area code 202, this is Sal. Are you just listening in or do you have a question?
Sal, you just cut Brian off.
The powerful role in the world. I'm not sure whether they're willing to resource to that powerful role. And to the extent that some of them are ready to resource, I sometimes think there is a bit more of a view of what it is that they wish to resource. There's less of a sense of a any sort of a broad defense buildup. I can't make predictions anymore. I think you're right. If the Democratic Party takes over the levers of government, defense spending will likely not increase much, if any, above the rate of inflation. That sort of a restriction just, you know, it forces the military to do what it's been doing, and that is to try to be innovative within the more innovative within the current resources they're provided, And there's plenty of evidence that they have done that. You know, I look at at all of the different unmanned platforms that have grown up over the course of the last 15 years, and I mean that's 15 years of continuing resolutions. It's 15 years of Democratic and split control of the legislature and the presidency. I mean, the bottom line is that there, innovation has continued even though there has been pressure on the dollars, and I think those sorts of pressures are no excuse not to continue to innovate.
And Brian, we have a caller with a question for you. What if three partners have decided to call in with a couple of questions for you? Brian, Jerry Hendricks is on the line. Would like to roll a couple of balls your way. Jerry, over to you.
Thanks, Brian. Great show tonight. And, you know, if you can't be good, be lucky to have you on tonight as all this news is breaking. So I have three questions for you. One, do you have any background on this retired Rear Admiral Braithwaite, who's rumored to be the SecDef's pick as the next SecNav, if you ever had interactions with him? Second, Viscosky, who is the chairman of the House Armed Appropriations Subcommittee, has announced his retirement. He was a guy who generally was thought of as being generally supportive. You know, what does his departure mean? And then the last one, on the topic you just touched on, do you think that unmanned platforms, specifically these large surface and underwater, should be counted against the ship count as we think about the future force function? And I will go back to listening patiently and respectfully.
Thanks, Jerry.
Jerry, it's good to hear your voice. I miss you. I miss you in social media, and I miss you in person, and I hope we get together soon. I'll take these in reverse. Judging the size of the Navy by the number of ships in it is an unsatisfying standard. It's probably a better one. I don't know what it is, though. At this point, it provides you an opportunity to compare the size of your Navy against – it's a good relative comparison against other navies. It's a good relative comparison against other U.S. navies of the past. It has some value. It does not count, for instance, large unmanned undersea vessels or large unmanned surface vessels. I would like – whoever is the Secretary of the Navy to take on board to get the folks from the third deck, to get the folks from the Joint Staff, from the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the White House, and then the relevant committee staffers, and go do an offsite and throw 75 pizzas in the room and come out of that room with some better way to evaluate naval power that – you know, that everyone agrees on, or at least enough people agree on that it doesn't get shut down if the Navy says we're going to count LUSVs or we're going to count LDUUVs in that ship count. The question about this human being that was you cited, this Rear Admiral Summer, somebody who's going to be the new Secretary of the Navy, I have no idea who that person is. I am not privy to the inner councils of this administration or its political appointees, and I don't expect to be consulted on who should be maybe. So I have no idea who that person was. I didn't catch the name or the relevance of the second thing that you brought up. Sal or Eagle Speak, did either one of you, Eagle One, did either one of you get that?
The name that's been thrown out in the Washington Post article, I believe, Frank Hoffman put it up there. The ambassador to Norway, Braithwaite, had another individual tell me he is a retired reserve chinfo and a friend of Pompeo. Braithwaite, Braithwaite, nice English name.
Yeah, I think the other name was an Armed Services Committee chairman or not chairman, obviously, but maybe a senior member who has also announced his retirement. I don't remember his name either, but that was the other question.
Hold on for a second. Jerry, if you're still on the line, we didn't write down the name of the individual you said was retiring. Who was that?
Yeah, so it's a Democratic Representative Viskoski of Indiana 1st District is the chairman of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. So he's been nominally a Democrat that can be counted upon to be supportive of these defense budgets. And he, a Democrat, has announced his retirement. And so I was wondering if Brian had thoughts, you know, about that and the implications for us there in the House.
Thanks, Jerry.
Yeah, I don't. I just don't. I don't. I'm not close enough to that caucus. I don't follow them as closely. I can't answer that, and I'm sorry.
Well, all right. Let's go back to talking about the effect of some of these other strategies. One of them is that, and I think somebody pointed this out in an article I read recently, that the combatant commanders are going to be kind of nervous, I would think, about the Navy fooling around with the way they distribute ships.
Well, let's bear in mind that the Chief of Naval Operations exercises operational control of not a single ship. That operational control of Navy ships is delegated to combatant commanders, who then further delegate them down to naval component commanders. So, to the degree that this dynamism may or may not be happening, it will be coming as a result of requirements that are at least discussed with the numbered fleet commanders and the naval component commanders. But I think what we have to recognize is that the numbered fleets and OPNAV are talking all the time. If there's a change to the global fleet management process, then the combatant commander has to put a request for forces in anyway, and the Navy gets to weigh in on whether it can fill that or not. So this adds a new wrinkle to the bargaining process between the force providers and the force operators. It'll be interesting to see how it washes out. But my guess is that you will have the luxury to be more dynamic if you grow. If the Navy gets larger, it can be more dynamic within the force structure.
Brian, I want to do a little time travel here. This week, an article that came out in November 2007, 12 years ago, came back to mind. And I want to get a pull quote from it just to get your angle on how we navalists that progress has been made. You know, back in 2007, you and I were both still in uniform. 12 years is the same period of time, for those who are history minded, from 1929 to 1941. And, you know, the end of 1920s Navy to the end of World War II. And of course, I'm talking about Robert Kaplan's article in the November 2007 edition of The Atlantic, titled America's Elegant Decline. And a little extended quote here from him, beginning of quote, "A great Navy is like oxygen. You notice it only when it's gone. Great navies help preserve national stability. 95% of imports and exports outside of North America travel by sea. 75% of the world's population is clustered within 200 nautical miles of the sea. The relative decline of our Navy is a big, dangerous force to which our elites seem blind." Unquote. Since Kaplan's bucket of water in 2007, have we made progress in that area about the same, or getting our elites of every stripe having a better understanding of the importance of naval power? Where does that stand?
I don't think that the decision makers, that the political class has any better understanding of the nexus between naval power and national power, or the contribution of naval power to security and prosperity. I don't think that they have any better idea now than they did in 2007. I consider the last few years somewhat of a lost opportunity. We had a president who was elected who wanted to be, I think the Navy is something – I think it's about 8 ships he took over. I think that's about it. Now, it takes time to – the trend lines, we put money into readiness in the first few years of this administration. That was Mattis. That was his decision, and it was a good one. There were a lot of holes in the dike, and – the little boys with their fingers had all walked away, and the dike was leaky. And we have a considerable amount of money in the readiness. We have raised readiness, and we have purchased more weapons. All of these were very good things. Priority Mattis had in his three priorities was to grow the force. And I've written before that the thing that gets a Navy to grow in this country is presidential support. You go back through our history, and I've written about this, about some of the naval, and in each case there was a president for whom it was a very important thing. I think the president wanted a bigger Navy. I don't know that he really did anything about it. And I think once Secretary Mattis came in, the whole, you know, because the entire defense enterprise needed work, if we were going to continue to resource to a strategy that doesn't make choices and which says that land power, space power, cyber power, sea power are all get their share, and that share is sort of immutable, we were unlikely to make any headway. Until we have a sustained conversation at the highest levels of this government about what we consider our defense priorities and then resource accordingly, I will tell you that I am fully prepared for there to be such a debate and for the Navy to lose out for sea power to be demonstrated as being less important, maybe, than I think it is. I'm fully prepared to be the case. I have never heard anybody make that argument successfully. I have never heard three component or constituent parts of that argument that make sense strung together. And quite frankly, I am ready to have this argument because I think it's a very winnable one. The he wants to have the argument. We'd rather just continue to resource the sort of same the same basic outline of forces, and then give the services some latitude within their quote-unquote budget share to innovate as they see fit. There haven't been any real strategic moves made, I would say, since 2001, which sort of, you know, behemoth that is the special forces world. I don't think there's been anything else strategic since then.
I'm interested in how the alliances we have. We've got the Brits now with 2 aircraft carriers. We've got Japan building what amount to aircraft carriers. We've got the effect of the F-35 being shown around the world, and a lot of other countries, the Aussies, getting interested in that. To what extent, I know it's our national defense strategy and it's our Navy strategy, but to what extent should we be looking, and I hate to bring back the 1,000-ship Navy, but the the concept of using, knowing that we have allies who have similar, if not exactly the same way we think about things, involved in this process. Does that assuage any of the concerns we have about our ability to meet some of these requirements?
I always thought the Thousand Ship Navy was a good idea. I think that naval forces, uniquely among elements of militaries, are used to working with each other. There is obviously the foundational element of rendering assistance to mariners in distress throughout the world that creates a bond among people who go to sea. I believe that the most important thing that gets other nations to invest in their defense is not our complaining about their insufficient spending, but their own local sense of physical threat. And we, for a long time, were, pushing on a wet noodle because there wasn't a perception of local threat. Lo and behold, the return of great power competition has incentivized other nations, selected other nations. Those other nations generally tend to be physically proximate to Russia and China. The further you are away from Russia and China, the less likely you are to fear great power competition, and the more likely you are to, especially in naval forces, value other things like the migration operations, for instance, motivates a good number of European navies, especially Mediterranean European navies. We need to be a catalytic force for naval power. I want us to have good friends with big guns standing right next to us and right behind us and out in front of us wherever we go. I want us to work with them to make sure that we move forward technologically together. Those are all important goals. What I never, ever, ever want to do is to rely on those relationships for our physical security. I want us to always be capable of a solid fight by ourselves or with our treaty allies, and other friends could come along as they will. I don't like the concept of a thousand ship navy turning into putting our security in someone else's hands. I know that's a little bit of a straw man argument. I know that makes fun of really smart people who have better ideas about these things. But ultimately, when you begin to move away from properly resourcing our military and start to say, well, that's their job or that's their job or that's their job, if they don't see it as their job, the job isn't going to get done. And I would rather the job gets done.
Yeah, I share your informed, lack of a better phrase, cynicism on the thousand ship Navy. It's nice if the auxiliary show up, but you need to be able to do it yourself. And as I'm at the end of the hour, I wanted to bring up, because one of the things we've talked about is we talked about messaging amongst ourselves, messaging and talking with the power centers at the Hill, the importance of the chief executive being a leader in that. But you've done something that I think everybody needs to use as a benchmark and a template that we've talked about for years, is the issue of telling our story to the taxpayers so more people get soaked in. You did a great job with your speaking tour. And we have another caller here that, you know, brings back, has a question for you about that messaging that we do amongst ourselves and our fellow citizens. So, caller, you had a question for Brian.
Yes. Hey, guys. Love the show. Brian, Kevin Miller here. My question is, as you're advocating in Washington for all things naval, what should the Navy League be doing out in the hinterlands or even in Old Town Alexandria to help?
Thanks, Kevin.
I have had interactions with the Navy League around the world. I believe, though, that the Navy League is hamstrung by its by how it is organized. All of the authority in the Navy League is exercised out in the provinces. The executive director in Washington and the staff in Washington, Navy League can and should be doing its best work, is a shadow of what it should be, and it takes. I remember reading the bylaws of the Navy League probably not more than 2 years ago, and just being shocked at the degree to which there was this unwieldy decision making organization made up of the of folks from the very little latitude able to be taken by the central Washington staff, ought to an advocacy organization on steroids. I think the Navy League would should do what should have a naval tank. I think they should have that the Navy League should fundraise and set up under its aegis. I think the Air Force Association has something like this. I forget what their think tank is called. I think General Deptula runs it. The Navy League should number one advocacy for naval, bar none, and it should and should fear it, and they should fear it because the Navy League can muster that local distributed network around the world to help what the Navy needs and what the country needs, and can do it. That's my deal. I would like to see the Navy League into a far more effective advocacy and lobbying organization, and it should have under its control a think tank that just chucks out like nobody's business, and sends speakers around the country to go and hit the rubber chicken circuit and do what I think the CNO ought to be having the flag community doing, by the way, which is to go out and tell the Navy story. That's not advocacy, that's education when it's done by an admiral. And I'd like to see that happening.
Hey, man, my father was a salesman his whole life. And one thing that the many things he said to me has always stuck with me. He's like, son, nobody owes you a living. Nobody owes us a fleet. Nobody owes us a strong Navy. A lot of times, you mentioned it well, there's a big education component that we're just not doing. As a salesman might say, you're not making the ask. And, you know, Brian, I think we could do another hour just on that topic, but we've chewed up enough of your pre-holiday preparation times. But before we let you go, could you share with us what are you working on right now that you can share with us that's occupying a lot of your time? And for those that follow you, where's a good place for them to keep an eye on what you might offer up in the marketplace of ideas next?
Well, Sal, my is Charlie Oscar November Sierra Hotel Oscar Cons Wahoo, short for Conservative Wahoo. You can follow me on Twitter at that handle. Working on right now and driving home through my former think tank. I left Hudson about 6 weeks ago. One more finish up. Seth Cropsey and I are going to December. I think we're looking at the 16th, but more on that. We're going to do an event where we discuss our latest report. We did a report on intelligence, reconnaissance, surveillance, and targeting shortfalls. And now, anybody who knows that topic understands that if you're going to go deep, you got to go classified. And we obviously can't do that. But what we did using, you know, pilot math and a sense of what we are buying, we tried to look at how well we would be able to maintain a constant surveillance inside the First Island chain. It's about 1.66 million square miles. And we looked at the degree to which our land SRT platforms would be able to do that. We can't obviously talk about overhead satellite assets because then you immediately go into the highest of classifications. But one of the things we believed in that report was that there would be so many customers clamoring for those assets, for one thing. And on the second thing, those assets are probably among some of the more lucrative targets in an early strike in a great power conflict. We wanted to see how well we could get to a solid understanding of where PLAN ships were within the First Island chain using our land-based platforms. And we did the math, and I think we did a pretty good job figuring out that you can't get there.
Well, on that note, Brian, if we don't have a chance to talk face-to-face, we'll at least be able to pop back over to Twitter. Wish you and yours a great holiday season, and do appreciate you taking time this Sunday to speak with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brian.
Thanksgiving season's greetings and Merry Christmas to all of you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney.